It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe. Later this hour, I'll talk with Iowa City poet Jen Rouse about her new collection, Acid and Tender. But first, the Annie Year tells the story of one particularly eventful year in a small town in northeastern Iowa. It's the debut novel of Stephanie Wilbur Ash, who grew up mostly in a small town in northeastern Iowa, Olwine. She is the editorial director of Gustavus Adolphus College and splits her time now between Minneapolis and Mankato, Minnesota, and she is with me now. Hello, Stephanie.
Hello, Charity. Hello, Iowa.
Thank you so much for being here today. And I would love for you, I know that you'd like to read to us a little bit from the beginning of the book, which introduces us to your character, Tandy Cade. And I'd like to get to know her right away. So could you read for us just a little bit from the beginning of the book?
I would love to. I will read you the first four paragraphs. You ready?
Yes, go.
The people in this town will try to tell you that the whole mess that was last year started with the new vocational agriculture teacher, but they would be wrong. I was there, so I know the truth. In fact, through my own mistakes and failures, the number of which I readily admit to you is plentiful, I caused much of it to happen. Obviously, I'm in a better position to recount the events than a busybody pastor or a senile doctor or an out-of-work rail worker or an old, crusty farmer who, though immensely wealthy, operates with the social skills of roadkill. Also, it is my profession to provide accurate accounting based on quantifiable facts. It is a profession I was raised into and have been making a reasonable living at for nearly 20 years. I've spent my entire life correcting the accounting mistakes of those very people I just mentioned. So, ask yourself, whom among us would you trust? It did not start with a vocational agriculture teacher, though I had heard there would be a new one, and, in the interest of accuracy, I must say that I was looking forward to meeting him. I was, in fact, curious about him. I had even asked those who had encountered him before me what their impressions of him were. I am a local taxpayer. It is perfectly natural for a taxpayer to be curious about the new public school teacher. Plus, new people do not often come into this town with the stated intention of sticking around, as the VOAG teacher had flagrantly declared to Sylvia von Trauer. I will live out the rest of my days here, he had told her. Such declarations were of great interest to all of us, though I don't expect people like you to understand that.
And that is the voice of Tandy Cade, who is the local certified public accountant, the only certified public accountant in town. She was born and raised in this town and left it only briefly for about a semester or so of college. And I know that the character of Tandy Cade came to you before the idea for the rest of the novel. So tell me about her.
So I was in the unusual situation of having to read a short story in a bar as an opening act for a notorious local band. And if you want to learn how to be a writer, that's a really rough start. So I had to make a story that was loud and unusual in its voice. And I had one joke, and if you read the book, you can see the joke. It's pretty evident. It's kind of a raunchy joke. And I built a character around that joke. And my dad was a small town CPA. He supported our family as a CPA for 25 years. And so I put a little bit of that in there. And it was a large enough joke that to have a kind of a deadpan straight delivery worked. And the story was funny. And it went from there.
And the voice of Tandy Cade is very important. We got a little flavor of that. She is a straight shooter. She tells you what she thinks, and even though her take on the world may not be the most trustworthy take on the world, but she will share it with you. Tell me more about how you think about her.
It's interesting. When the movie The Accountant with Ben Affleck came out, I was like, oh, God, that is exactly right. And if you know, Ben Affleck's character is autistic in that movie. And several people had said to me early on when I was writing this book, is Tandy autistic? And I said, no, she's not. But she is specific. And she is fact-based. Her profession demands it. But also, when you live in an insular community, it's sort of a means of survival. The subtleties and the emotional dramas that you can't escape from when you're in a small town can be relieved by being very cut and dry. She also is unreliable because, you know, like all of us, she's in process, and she has gone through a pretty difficult year at the time that she is speaking in this novel. She's had a transformative experience in the form of an extramarital affair with a VOAG teacher. So she's trying to be as specific as possible about her experience, and I think also debunk some of the small talk about her.
Well, and this vocational agriculture teacher that comes to town, he is a little bit of a stereotype, I guess you could say. He comes in with his...
Well, he's pretty sexy, too.
Maybe
it's a sexy stereotype.
And
he has a ponytail.
Man-togs.
Yes.
And
some people find that attractive, Jared.
He's coming into town with some a lot of ideas about organic agriculture and the place of this town in the larger world and helping.
Yes, and he's been in the Peace Corps. You know, he's been places. He wants to be helpful.
Very, very helpful. All right, so he comes into town and he seems to have this incredible naivete about him as well. He has these ideas, but a complete lack of understanding of the town that he's coming into.
Yes, he does. And there's some comedy there in the novel, sort of playing his naivete against the real pragmatism of Tandy Cade, who is a longtime businesswoman and really embedded in the town, a respectable person in the town.
So
but it's also very attractive, you know, like when you're like Tandy has had very little encounters with people outside of her town, except what she has seen on television. And the one semester she went to college 14 miles away. So, you know, he comes to town and it's attractive. You know, he is a real kind of an exotic creature, even though he is pretty clueless. Yeah, he's clueless.
Which she comes to realize not, I mean, fairly quickly, actually.
Yeah.
Although she's
almost
still
from
seduced,
the start.
Still
yes.
Seduced by the idea of him and by his presence, although she understands that he is fairly clueless.
Yeah. And she, in the telling of the book, she's trying to give herself a pass about that. You know, she knows that she is wrong right away, but she also gives herself a pass by saying, and Mueller, the farmer in the book, also, you know, says everybody gets to make a mistake once in a while, Tandy. So this book is a little bit confessional as well.
So the book is very funny, and I feel like we should explain the title, The Annie Year, because that's where we begin in the book, although it's not really the pivotal plot point in the book. It's called The Annie Year because this is the year that the high school is putting on the play Annie, and it kind of cycles through a number of different musicals that they produce based on the talent at hand. So it tells you a little bit of something about the people in the town. It's a point that brings the people in the town together. And the book, Stephanie, no one really comes off looking great in the book. It's a very funny book, but we don't have really a moral center. We don't really have a hero that we want to look to in the book. And there's so much in the book, so many details about the people and their relationships that I can tell that you have experience and affection for these people. But some people could look at this book and say, wow, she just really wrote a scathing book about life in a small town.
You know, it's interesting because the reviews, and there have been a lot of reviews of this book, and some of them have been, oh, this is a scathing look at at small towns. But there have been many who have said, this book is really written with a lot of love for small towns. And I would argue that there isn't a moral center. I think there is very much a moral center, and it's centered on doing what it is that you know is right, even as you're making mistakes about it. And there is a point where Tandy takes a stand. It's not the stand you want for her necessarily, I think. I've had readers say that. It's an unexpected stand. It's not for the VOAG teacher, though she does take a stand for him in some ways, and that might be considered immoral. But the moral center relies on duty, responsibility, on doing what it is that you say that you're going to do. And I think that's really special.
When you think about growing up in a small town, I mean, did this idea come from a place of wondering, what would it have been like if I didn't leave?
Absolutely. Like I said, my dad was a small town CPA, and I was raised mostly in Olwine, and almost all of my people are small business people, farmers or hardware stores or car dealerships, you know, really people who were highly individualistic and made a living for their families with business. So I did ask myself, what would have happened if for some reason my father had died and I had to come back from college and run his business? Now, I have no aptitude or interest in accounting. I would not call that my skill set or my gift. But I knew a bit about it, so it was plausible.
We're going to take a short break. We'll be back in just a moment. My guest right now is Stephanie Wilbur Ash. She is the author of the novel The Annie Year. It's her debut novel, and she will be doing a reading at Dragonfly Books in Decorah on Friday, February 17th at 7 p.m. We'll continue our conversation in just a moment. This is Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe. Coming up in a few minutes, a conversation with Jen Rouse. She's an Iowa City-based poet and playwright. Her new collection is called Acid and Tender. Right now, I'm talking with Stephanie Wilbur Ash. She's the author of the novel The Annie Year, which tells the story of a very eventful year in a small town in northeastern Iowa from the perspective of the local CPA, Tandy Cade. And we've been talking about growing up in a small town in northeastern Iowa, Stephanie, and the idea that this grew out of sort of a playful imagining on your part of what would have happened if I never left Olwine, Iowa, if I grew up and started a small business and stayed put, like a number of people do, of course, at least hopefully to keep small towns thriving and moving forward. As you did leave town. You left town, you graduated from high school in 1992, and you left town at a time that was really tough in rural Iowa. Of course, we'd been through the farm crisis, and a lot of small towns never really recovered from that in many ways. And then in the 90s and in the early 2000s in particular, there was a lot of methamphetamine use and manufacturing going on in rural areas all over the state of Iowa. Was that something that you observed happening in your hometown from a distance?
Yeah, I left Olwine in 1992, and I went to the University of Iowa for college, so I didn't go too far at first. And it was very shortly after that, I think, that the methamphetamine scourge epidemic happening, whatever you want to call it, that it really became really prevalent. And that really informs this book. In the book, homes often in town blow up. They blow up, or they have explosions inside of them, because the methamphetamine trade is and production is happening all of the time. And it's a key piece of the plot in the book. But yeah, it was definitely happening after I left. And there was a really notable book, Methland, The Death and Life of a Small Town, by Nick Redding, that really uses Olwine, Iowa, as its example. And that book came out while I was just beginning to write this novel. And so I used that. I definitely used that. And I used it, I think, in a what I would call an insider-outsider way. I was an insider in Olwine, you know, essentially raised there, insider in rural Iowa communities. But at the time that book came out, I'd been living in Minneapolis for 10 years. So I understood the appeal of that book, and I also understood the sort of pain around that as well. And so I think with this book, I'm trying to find a space in there. You know, I'm trying to reconcile that in with a character who is true, funny, you know, ironic, I suppose. But yeah, you know, I'm trying to find a space in there.
You were also inspired in writing this book, and the name of your main character comes from a collection of stories by Sherwood Anderson. And Winesburg, Ohio is where the name Tandy comes from, although Sherwood Anderson also wrote other books looking at small-town life in the Midwest. Again, not in a very flattering light. So there was a lot of satire about the people who lived and made up these small towns.
Yeah, that's an interesting book. And if you are living in a small town now, you should read Sherwood Anderson's Winesburg, Ohio. The story of Tandy in that book, Tandy is there's a little girl. She's probably 5 or 6 years old. And a drunk walks by her home one night and sits down and tells her how it is that women should love. And he has named this quality in a woman, this perfect love, he's named it Tandy. And when her father puts her to bed later that night, he calls her by her name and she says, "No, no, I'm Tandy." And he says, "No, you're not." And that's essentially the end of the story. And so when I read that story, I thought, wow, that's a really terrible thing to do. Both of those things are terrible. And I gave my character that name and a cast of men in this novel who are telling her what to do pretty much all of the time. And in a kind of a mean way, in a way that's not really about her, that's about them. And that's where that name came from. I also read a transformative essay by Paul Groucot in a collection of essays called Grassroots. And the essay is titled What We Teach Our Rural Children. And the answer is, if you were any good, you wouldn't be here. And when I read that, you know, at the time I had a short story, I had a funny short story with an unusual Midwestern woman protagonist. When I read that, I thought this could be a novel. That's a very deep psychological space to live in, and a space that I lived in. You know, I being born and raised in rural Iowa at the particular time that I was there. Those two things made this book a novel, or made this short story a novel.
Do you feel like you were raised with that belief that if you were worth your salt, you'd get out of town and do something else?
I can say yes, but it didn't come from my family. My family is amazing and supportive. My extended family, you know, always adored me. But I think there wasn't a lot of representation in mainstream media, as we like to say, mainstream media. There wasn't a lot of representation on television, or even in the books that I read in high school, about who I was, you know, about the kind of life that I was living. And, you know, it was the beginning of MTV, or sort of the, you know, middle excellent space of MTV. And it was really urban, you know, it was about large cities. It seemed like if you were anybody special, you lived in a a large city and you had a fabulous intellectual life and you went to coffee shops and you had many smart friends and you had cute clothes and, you know, a beautiful apartment in New York City. And, you know, except for the show Roseanne, where I really saw myself, I think there was sort of this underlying idea that you could do better elsewhere. I don't believe that's necessarily true, but it was like an imprint overlaid on me. And I refuse to believe that. And my character, Tandy, has a sense of that. And that's where, you know, she has a direct address to the reader, which is an unusual thing about the novel.
Right. And we just heard a little bit of it in the paragraphs you read. Such declarations were of great interest to all of us, though I don't expect people like you to understand that. She also talks often about people like you who live closer to the river, people like you in your big cities with your ideas. There's certainly, she has an idea of what other people are like and what they think, whether it's right or wrong.
Right. She knows what you think about her. Because she's seen, you know, she sees it on television. Or she has this idea. And it isn't just, in the novel, it isn't just coming from media. It's also coming from the characters who believe it about themselves. And so there is in the novel this sort of perpetuation of the idea that we're all just here slowly waiting to die. You know, the men who purport to take care of her start a club called the Order of the Pessimists, which I have to say is a real thing I read in the Cedar Rapids Gazette in the mid-90s. So kudos to those out there who started the Order of the Pessimists. It's central to my novel, and I appreciate you.
I'm talking with Stephanie Wilbur Ash. Her debut novel is called The Annie Year. It tells the tale of an eventful year in a small town in northeastern Iowa, told through the eyes of the local CPA, Tandy Cade, who goes through a whole lot in that year and makes some interesting choices. So right now, we are going through this time as a nation where I don't think it's ever been more evident, this divide between rural and urban. And we have this divide in Iowa between rural and urban. I'm sure in Minnesota it's really evident as well. And your novel really treads that line and throws it into sharp relief. Is there something you want the reader to understand, to take away when, you know, you're addressing those of us who live closer to the river? What do you want us to get out of this experience other than some laughs?
Well, it's interesting to talk about this because, you know, this novel was bagged and tagged 2.5 years before Donald Trump was elected president. So I did not write it with the intention of articulating the divide between rural and urban. That it didn't come from that. It came from a much more personal, artistic space, though. I think the feelings are there. You know, there is that unrest in the divide, and that's where the direct address comes from. Tandy believes that she is different than, you know, people who have things in urban areas. It's interesting that while I was writing the novel, I came up with the last three sentences before I had finished it. In fact, before I probably only had 100 pages. And those last sentences are, do not mess with us. Do not mess with us ever. And so when Hillary Clinton did not win the presidency, you know, in Minneapolis, so many people were shocked. And I was not. I was not shocked. I suppose that it was prophetic.
You started this process of writing this novel, it sounds like many years ago. How long did you spend writing The Annie Year?
Wow. Writing it, maybe 9 years. And it's interesting because that question, like, how long did it take you to write the novel? I wasn't at the desk for 9 straight years.
You're a busy woman. You're a mother.
Right?
You're a working mother. You've done a lot of other things.
I was raising kids. I was working. I was making some other kinds of performative art, radio and musical theater. And, you know, Tandy was a character that was just kind of always there. At one point, Tandy had a blog. It was so funny. People would write in to ask Tandy their tax and personal questions. Like, I still pine for my ex-girlfriend. Can I claim her on my tax return?
And what would Tandy say to that question?
Oh, Tandy would have amazing responses to that, very cold and calculated responses, but also, you know, really kind of questioning responses that she would reflect back to her own self and her own wonder about what it means to pine for someone. So, you know, I was writing that. I was writing the novel in some interesting ways for a long time before I put it into a more novelistic structure. And that, you know, it takes a long time. But when I was finished, I was very, very glad to be finished with it. But I still really haven't tired of her. I think about her all the time. That's what I was just going to ask you,
because clearly she was a character who came to you before the novel. She had this long life during the development of the novel, and she has this very singular voice. And even we had an email exchange, and I could tell that you were slipping a little bit into Tandy in one of your comments, where you were telling me what other people had had asked you, and you said, "She's not very likable. I didn't really like her." And your response was, "I didn't know you were supposed to like her. Also, this is not a question." And I thought, well, there's Tandy right there.
She has this thing. Tandy has this thing where if she asks you a question and then you respond with a question, she says, "Don't answer a question with a question. A question is not an answer." And that this is her way of combating the sort of like natural Midwestern passive aggressiveness of not being able to be direct. Like, Tandy does not have time for that. She is going to be direct with you. And it's funny, like, I do think about her every day, and things happen, and I say things, and my husband will be like, "Oh, that's so Tandy."
So who is she for you? Does she inspire you?
You know, when I get confused about something, when I am worried about whether or not I'm making the right choice, when I get kind of worked up with the anxieties of life, I do think about Tandy, and I do think, like, what would Tandy Cade do? And usually what Tandy Cade would do is shut up and move forward. You know, just, you know, all of the worries about how other people feel should not be your concern. Your concern is your work. However you're defining your work, you should move forward in your work. Now, I also remember Tandy Cade in that you have to be nice to other people, because they rely on you for something and you rely on them for something. So play nice in that space. And that's good business. But worrying about what other people think of you is a useless exercise.
So she guides you a little bit, even though she's been known to make some really terrible choices.
Oh, she makes some terrible choices. Oh, she makes some foolish choices.
You know, she talks a lot about how she has learned that you can hold two ideas in your head at the same time, and they can disagree with each other, but both be true at the same time. She returns to this idea again and again.
This is mind-blowing to her. Yes, it is mind-blowing. It is mind-blowing to her. And I've heard people say that this is a coming-of-age novel about a grown woman. And I think that's very apt. You know, like, so much of our coming-of-age novels are, you know, YA, young adult literature. You know, you come of age at 18 years old and suddenly, oh, look at you. You're now who you're going to be. But that's not true. I mean, we're coming of age at pivotal points in our life, you know, for the entirety of our lives. And so Tandy comes of age, and she comes to that idea that there is, you can have two things. You that something can be both wrong and right. And for a CPA, that's really mind-blowing. But also for, you know, a grown woman, it's a good thing to know.
Stephanie, thank you so much for talking with me.
Oh, thank you, Charity. Thank you so much.
Stephanie Wilbur Ash, her debut novel is called The Annie Year, and her main character is Tandy Cade, the local CPA in a small town in northeastern Iowa. Coming up in just a moment, I'll talk with Iowa City-based poet and playwright Jen Rouse about her new poetry collection, Acid and Tender. This is Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe. Jen Rouse is a poet and playwright who lives in Iowa City. She's just published a new collection of poetry called Acid and Tender, much of it inspired by the life and work of the artist Frida Kahlo. She's also a consulting librarian at Cornell College in Mount Vernon, and she is here with me now. Hello, Jen.
Hello. Thanks for having me.
Well, thank you so much for being here today. And let's start with just a little bit about you. How long have you been writing poetry?
Oh, since I was probably about 14.
Now, a lot of 14-year-olds write poetry,
right, yeah.
And then it passes. And a lot of it's not very good. But
that is definitely the truth.
Right. So what is it that kept you with poetry? What is it about expressing yourself in that way that made you want to keep doing it?
You know, I thought I was going to be a visual artist growing up, and that kind of changed course when I was in high school, and I realized that I could do so much more with literature, that I could be so much more present on the page. And it's kind of like riding a bike. You can try to give it up, you know, you can walk away from it from a little bit, but it's always with me, and it really is something that's a constant in my life. So,
where did you grow up?
I grew up in Des Moines. I went to high school in Sioux Falls, South Dakota. I went to Iowa State. I went to American University in Washington, D.C. I taught high school in Las Vegas and prep school in Washington, D.C. I've been around.
But drawn back to Iowa,
mm-hmm.
What brought you back to the state?
I think that there is a sense of space that never leaves us, really, right? So I can live in a big city and love that for about 5 years, and then I want a cornfield and a beautiful blue sky, and I want to drive for miles. And I really am attracted to that. So,
as a writer, mm-hmm. you've done a lot of different things. And when people give young people advice, they don't tend to tell them to be poets because it's a difficult life.
It is.
Did you ever try to resist it? Did you ever think I need to go in a different direction?
Absolutely not. But I never made it my work. Right. So I've always been an educator. I've always been a teacher. And poetry has always been something that I've been able to love and completely just be passionate about it. So it was never about whether I was publishing or, you know, whether I was, you know, the big star on the poetry circuit, you know, because there is, you know, big stars on poetry circuits,
right.
Of course. Right? anyway, it just really always has been with me, and it's never something that I've considered giving up.
So, when do you write poetry? If it's not the central focus of your work,
mm-hmm.
Obviously it's something that keeps coming back to you. What is a moment that makes you think, I need to sit down and write?
So I'm very lucky. I have a group of friends, and we come together online, right? And we write probably 3 times a year intensely for a month on a blog, very private, very supportive, right? So we've kind of gone through this place in our lives where we don't really need critical workshopping anymore. We've all been through school. We've done our MFAs. We're okay with that. But now we're just really good friends. And so these are my peeps. These are the people that tell me, this is good. This is okay. This needs to go out into the universe. And so I have a lot of support in that area. So I don't write all the time. I am not one of those people that gets up at 5 a.m. and says, I'm gonna get into my writing day. You know, this is my morning writing workout. Absolutely not. I'm not going to be that person.
So now much of the poetry in this book is inspired by the life and work of Frida Kahlo.
Mm-hmm.
What is, you mentioned thinking that you were going to be a visual artist mm-hmm. when you were a young person. What's your relationship with Frida Kahlo and her work?
You know, being in D.C., I got to see a lot of her work. And then I think my draw isn't necessarily to her life, to her biography. It is to her way of creating. So I think we're both confessional artists. I think we are both reinventors of selves. We were very kind of bold, brave out there. You know, poetry does not ask for complacency, and neither does Frida's art, right? I think she's a symbol of being a really strong warrior, and I admire that.
Her biography does make it into your poetry, though, and of course, for people who don't know, she was in a terrible, terrible accident.
Yes.
Her pelvis was punctured, basically, mm-hmm. and so her road back to a semblance of health was very long. She always had pain, and she had to wear this sort of plaster corset
Absolutely.
For a very long time to be able to support herself.
Mm-hmm.
And so the biography does become part of your poetry.
She does say, you know, over and again, the person that I know the best is myself. I spend the most time with myself. I am alone, so who am I going to paint? I'm going to paint myself, right? And I think that's true. I think that I live with that a little bit and inside my psyche as well. And that's where a lot of my work comes from.
Could you read a couple of the poems inspired by Frida Kahlo for us?
I'd love to. The first one that I think is really about kind of creating that space as a poet, as a woman in this world is called Love's Anatomy. Here is the window, your breath and back against, my hand on the glass and longing, tethered, tethered. There was nothing surreal in our self-portrait of stars, fallen, flooded, and spilled. This womb through all our fingers. I tried so hard to catch you, stitched and severed, but when I opened my mouth to scream, only my heart flew out, a child's balloon, a lost umbilicus. I will have to walk out of here alone. I will have to change my name. Once more, I will have to love something that I will lose. Tell me again the story of why we are here. Tell me again the story of hummingbirds and thorns.
That's Jen Rouse reading Love's Anatomy from her collection Acid and Tender, inspired by Frida Kahlo. You have so many poems inspired by Frida Kahlo here. How did the collection come about? Because, you know, I can imagine it started with one poem, but did you just feel like you couldn't be done there?
I don't think I'll ever be done with Frida, but it started because there was a showing. Diego and Frida were together at the Detroit Institute of Arts just a few months ago. And I thought, I have to go. This is the trip, right? I need to see all of her work in one space. I must get there. And you know how you do, right? You never plan the trip. And so at 2 a.m., I got in the car and I went to Detroit and I saw that show. I stood in a line with hundreds of people and I thought, I'm not going to see anything. Her work is so small. Why did I bother? And I went to that room and I was transformed. I was taken, you know, I was completely in love with being there and seeing her work and getting to be that close to her. And then I came out of that and I wrote most of the book on a bench in the museum. So
really?
That first half of the book was done.
Wow. Well, read us another. This is the poem that gives the book its title, Acid and Tender.
Acid and Tender, you bet. You stand on pedestals upstage, hovering in shadow. You wait for me to pull you into the light. Don't you know? I want you to choose the self you want me to see. One of you is in a suit too large and suspended and silly, your grin. One of you is all thorns and stoicism, not a breath of air between us. And one of you is shedding all your organs, trading for wings, scalpel and spine. You pull your rib cage apart. You feed me small bits of your petrified heart. I will never know who we were supposed to be.
Acid and Tender by Jen Rouse. And The book is published, the collection is published by Headmistress Press, which is a small, fairly new press, and I just pulled this from their website. Mm-hmm. Co-founded by Mary Merriam and Risa Denenberg in 2013, Headmistress Press is an independent publisher of books and poetry by lesbians. Mm-hmm. As a small press, HP is dedicated to honoring lesbian existence, discovering a range of lesbian voices, and promoting lesbian representation in the arts. So this is a fairly new venture, only a few years, but tell me why you think, and you didn't found the press, obviously, but why do you think it's important to have a press dedicated to publishing books of poetry by lesbian writers?
You know, I think that for so long I didn't look for my community in writing, right? I did not pay as much attention as I should have to lesbians writing. You know, I always had my favorites, Adrienne Rich, of course, who will tell you that the personal is always political, and yeah, kind of the love song with her, but I didn't look further than that. And so I think this press really brings a lot of our voices to life and to light, and especially now in a time when we're gonna start I think ignoring women's voices in many ways, creating that space as artists, creating that space as lesbian artists, very important. And this press has been very good to me, very dedicated. I think being a small press, they get to spend a lot of time with their authors, and it's just been a joy, a real joy to work with them.
Did you have any concerns about publishing with a small niche press, thinking, you know, how obviously your poetry speaks beyond this community. Mm-hmm. So were you concerned at all about maybe pigeonholing yourself as a writer?
That's a really good question. I hope, you know, because I publish in such a wide variety of places and journals, that this was a really wonderful starting spot. It's opened up doors to other presses. People have taken interest. So it really was a way for me to get out into the world in a way that I hadn't chosen to before. So, you know, not too much worry.
And looking around on their website, they have they have a collection of lesbian poet trading cards.
I can hook you up with a set of those. They are wonderful. And I aspire to be a part of that set one day. I just hope they know.
Right. So what does that mean to you? I mean, it's a fun, playful way to celebrate this community, obviously.
Absolutely.
But what does it mean to you as a lesbian poet to see somebody doing this?
I think we've come a long way. I think that you get to see the journey. I think that a lot of women have worked very hard before I ever got to sit in this spot with you, and they deserve that honor. They deserve to be there. Audre Lorde, Adrienne Rich, you know, those women, incredible poets. The woman that that I was a finalist for this competition, Charlotte Mew, she was turn of the century lesbian poet. Yeah, you know, who's going to know about her unless a press like this really brings her into the forefront? You know, that's an honor to be a finalist and for a prize like that.
And the collection, the first part of the collection is overtly about Frida Kahlo, mm-hmm. the acid part of the collection. Tender is more, I would say, more personal and maybe less clear. What it's about is, are those poems more personal for you?
I think they are. I think they're still about what it means to be, you know, a woman writer, taking on all the roles that we do, you know, spouse, partner, mother, lover, friend. We're in so many spaces. And so I think these poems kind of cover the range of who I am and what I do and how I still find time to create. And there are also poems about my connection to my grandmother, connections to the really important women in my life. So you'll see that in poems like Phoenix in a Coffee Shop and Letter to Little Hummingbird, the ways that I still get to speak to people that I might not necessarily be in contact with each other.
And how do you see the poems in this more personal part of the book, mm-hmm. connecting to the poems that were inspired by Frida Kahlo? What are the ties for you?
Again, being confessional poets, I think that their voices are very bold. We don't hold back. You really do see a kind of a truth in both of us, even though it might seem masked or hidden in that kind of fabulous fairy tale approach or the symbol of the hummingbird. There's a lot that seems to hide us, and yet we're very blatantly out there. So that's the way that I see us connecting as artists.
Would you read one of the poems in this, the tender part
Absolutely.
Of the book?
Let's do Phoenix in a Coffee Shop. In the beginning, there is another beginning. I will bring no one you know. I will bring nothing you remember. No one packed my things, but it doesn't really matter. Do you see how the edges blur, old lumber and patinaed metal, idle hands raising cups, lowering cups, and mouths that no longer listen? I will bring an odd kind of laughter, slopping against the sides of this wide open wound, coffee black, no sugar. In the beginning, I let you. In the beginning asks that I bring another. I will expect no one. I will not ask for permission. I have risen from the middle so many times, even the ashes are uncertain. I will part the room in a sea of red. I will reassure, pat your hand. In the beginning makes it clear, there is nothing left of what I knew.
Jen Rouse reading from her collection, Acid and Tender. And you are a poet. You are also a playwright. And although your poetry is published and written down, is there something, obviously poetry or on it, or frequently poetry is read aloud. Is there something about writing for the spoken word that appeals to you, that draws you to both writing plays and poetry?
Absolutely so. I'm a crazy introvert, and playwriting has made all the difference in my life because I got to give all those poems, all those characters to a cast who would speak them for me. and I really enjoyed that, right? So, and I can extend the story of Frida. I can do so much more with what the poems make themselves available to do. So the playwriting is a lot of fun, and it involves so many more people. So that's been a great honor. I've got to do some playwright, producing some plays at Theater Rapids, and SPT Theater did a stage reading of a play called Conjure this fall, directed by Genevieve West. Yeah, we're just having a great time with that. It's not something that I thought that I would do with my life. So, no pressure. Whatever we end up with is fantastic.
Well, Jen Rouse, thank you so much for talking with me today.
It's been my pleasure. Thank you, Charity.
Jen Rouse, her new collection of poetry is called Acid and Tender. It's a finalist for the Charlotte Mew Prize and published by Headmistress Press. Talk of Iowa is produced by Dennis Reese, Emily Woodbury, Claire Roth, and Lindsay Moon. I'm Charity Nebbe. This is Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio.